This is
Make It Kind.
M.I.P.
with Masamela Matfumo.
Mark Thompson.
Make It Kind.
Get woke.
New from Radiotopia presents Red for Revolution, an audio drama about Black love, queer romance, and liberation. Join Jasmine, an 18-year-old navigating her queer identity while learning about her grandmother's secret love affair. Through her discoveries, we're transported back to 1971 to witness two remarkable women embark on a romance that defies all conventions. Subscribe to Radiotopia Presents and listen to Red for Revolution wherever you get your podcasts.
Joining us now, we originally had planned for our guest to discuss the latest in the Congo, as he's joined us before on that topic, and also to discuss the latest in Nigeria. And then Venezuela pops off. He's got some experience there. So we've got a full slate with our first guests. No stranger, of course, with the Center for Research on the Congo, Kinshasa, our dear brother from the Congo, Kambale Musavuli. My brother, how are you?
Well, it's a difficult question to respond to, right? I would say I'm fine. I just spent the holidays with my family. And it was a staunch reminder of the urgency of the Congo. Because, I mean, you know how people you get in a holiday spirit and you're talking, and then family members are reminding you of people who have died, right? You know, myself included, like I've lost family members. So we're talking about our two uncles who've been killed in the East, my grandfather who passed away, right? So we were discussing just their lives, you know, and what they wish for the Congo. So I'm saying I was happy to be with the family, but I also was reminded of why we must fight for a free Congo, because this is very real to people on the ground on a daily basis.
So let me start there. I want to be empathetic to that. Your two uncles were killed?
Yes. One was killed in Kisangani. They say that he was killed by a rebel group called ADF. Another in the Kivu province. On my mother's side, one was a priest. He was kidnapped in 2012 and was found decapitated in 2014. So there are so many stories. I can go on and on, even like colleagues with whom I worked. And for people who've heard about the situation in the Congo last year, you may have heard that the city of Goma was taken over by rebels earlier last year. But the process of that, you know, think about there were wounded soldiers, right? I'm sharing one particular story, and I'll do my best to not disclose much. But the Congolese soldiers who were wounded were in a hospital. So when the rebel took over the town, they went into the hospital and they stabbed to death some of the soldiers. And they took some of the soldiers from the deathbed, took them away. And the nurses who were there, they were just shocked that, you know, this is a act of war, right? It's a war crime to kill wounded soldiers inside of a hospital. And then from then to now, the city is still under the occupation of rebel groups. So ordinary people get lost in this story, right? When we read the Al Jazeera, we read the CNN, of this rebel group has taken over this town. The government is negotiating. Now they're showing up in Washington signing peace accords. On a daily basis, ordinary citizens are still being abused. They have lost ones, loved ones. They don't know if some of them are alive or dead. And many people are still being killed. So this is the reality of many Congolese in the eastern part of Congo, and they're tired of it. After 29 years of conflict, they want peace. You know, now actually we're going to 30 years now. Since 1996, we've had this conflict, right? So they want to see peace, and we know this peace is not theoretical. No, it has to have justice for it to last.
So wait a minute. As you said, there was a peace agreement.
Indeed.
So reconcile the ongoing rebel violence, and which rebels are we talking about? Reconcile that with this peace agreement.
So the peace agreement that Trump organize. It's part of four agreements that the Congo signed. Is they call it the Washington Accords. One is the peace agreement between DRC and Rwanda. Another is an economic framework for sharing Congo's resources. The third one is a bilateral agreement between DRC and the U.S. to access Congo's minerals. And the fourth one is more a Rwanda-U.S. engagement, right? So that's what they're calling the Washington Accord. Even though one of the agreements is supposed to be a peace accord, rebels have continued to take over town. So I'll give you an example. On December 4th of 2025, they signed this agreement in Washington, D.C. On December 5th, the rebels, backed by the Rwandan military, moved over to take another town, right? The town of Uvira. And then I'm sure people will be following it closely. So in the press, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. calling out Rwanda, the U.S. Security Council, and so on. So what does it mean to sign an agreement when the next day hundreds of people are being displaced, people are still being killed? But you should listen to Trump himself, right? When Trump had the president of Congo and Rwanda in Washington to sign this agreement, if you listen closely to his speech, he kept talking about money, right? And said, we are going to make a lot of money. This is the same president, I think a couple of years ago, in his campaign trail, he talked derogatory about the DRC, right? He was saying that Congolese prisoners are being released from Congo and being pushed into the U.S., right? When he had his push about immigrants. So he's talking about how people are killing themselves with machete. All of a sudden, he's a businessman, right? He's not talking about how much money he's going to make. So the agreement signed in Washington is not going to bring peace. What he actually has done, I don't think we'll have time to go through the whole agreement. What they have actually done by the Congolese government signing this agreement is giving Congo's minerals in control of the United States. What do I mean by that? They've created a council of 10 individuals, 5 in the U.S. and 5 in the Congo. They have to come up with a list of strategic minerals that include gold, coltan, lithium, and so on, mm-hmm. and build up U.S. reserve of these minerals. Without consultation of the Congolese parliament, without consultation of the Congolese people, right? So now you have like a body that controls strategic minerals in DRC without any engagement of Congolese themselves to even understand what was signed, right? This is similar to what happened at the Berlin Conference in 1885, the carving up of the African continent. So Trump is the new King Leopold of the DRC, where he's literally controlling Congo's vast mineral wealth for his own benefit, because it's not for the benefit of the American people. It's for the benefit of the Eric Prince of Blackwater, who's engaging DRC. He has his mercenaries in DRC with Bill Gates, who has the company Cobalt Metals. They just signed a $1 billion deal to get access to the largest lithium reserve in the world. Right? Cobalt Metals, owned by Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, now have access to lithium. And many more American companies are salivating over this deal. And in the end, for us Congolese, we're not seeing any benefit from it, and we're not seeing any peace since the signing of the agreement.
So it is just untrue and mythical that this is a peace agreement, one, but you're also saying, Kambale, I want to just go a little bit more deeply into this. Do those minerals include the minerals that we often talk about
Indeed.
That we use for our electronics?
It did. The coltan that's in your cell phone, your laptop, is going to be part of that strategic reserve list. The cobalt, I mean, it's even so bad that in the agreement itself, they literally put in writing that any project that the U.S. will do will have to get Americans to have 51%. Completely against our own mining laws in Congo. So the American companies are going to have, from the start, a majority stake in any mining project in DRC.
And that includes cobalt and coltan.
Cobalt, coltan, lithium, copper, gold. And they've listed that. They've created a committee to list that. On the document, they did put strategic minerals, and the strategic minerals are coltan, are cobalt, are lithium. So that's already part of the list. But it's going for any, let's say an American company decides to do lithium in Congo. According to that agreement, the American company get automatically 51% in terms of the stake in the project, automatically, which is actually against our own laws. So by signing this, what is going to now unfold is that they have put the Congolese government in a position where they have to force the Congolese parliament to change its laws. And they actually put that in the agreement that they have about, if I'm not mistaken, 30 days for a few steps to come up with the list of the 10 people who are going to be managing the strategic reserve, the council itself, to engage with the Congolese institution, about a year for the DRC to amend its constitution, its laws, to facilitate the implementation of this agreement. So they're literally imposing US corporate interest on the Congolese in the name of peace and hoping that people or Congolese are not gonna read it. But we are reading it and we are clear. Many people already on the ground have denounced it. They said that it does not make sense that the president of the Congo, the Minister of Foreign Affairs and others can come to Washington to sign an agreement that has not been actually ratified in parliament. This has to be discussed. If we are going to give Americans access to minerals in DRC with an determined time, right? That's also another clause in the agreement. If we're giving them these minerals, that is the future of the Congo, at the very least, it must be debated in the National Assembly with the 500 members of parliament that we have, so that the people themselves know the content of the what was signed, and they can actually voice the concern that, no, if it's my mineral, you cannot hire 51%, right? Because this is what the Congolese people have been fighting for, that we need a fair share the mining project taking place in the Congo, and that many people actually have been, you know, kicked out of parliament, civil society organization, have been pushed to silence for anyone who has fought to change Congo's mining law to be fair. And the mining laws of the Congo as of today is actually much better than before. But with the imposition of the U.S., they are forcing us to change it.
A couple of follow-ups. The mining laws today, does the Congo get to keep its own money or more of its own money before this 51% agreement?
Indeed. And seven giant mining companies, whenever this was passed in 2018, mostly American companies, were against Congo passing the new mining code. The new mining code came into effect in 2018. And in the new mining code, they added an element where they say that for any project that takes place, the majority shareholder must be Congolese. The Good. U.S. came up now with this agreement where they said, no, the majority shareholder has to be American.
So what about, what is Parliament doing? Is Parliament pushing back against this? What's the nature of Parliament? Obviously, the executive branch signed it, they're for it, right?
Indeed. The executive branch is for it. As of today, I do not see any MP quite vocal about it at the moment. Some have reached out to us at the Center for Research on the Congo privately to help them in drafting letters that they would make public. And they've been sitting on this letter for a week. I won't disclose the number of the MP, where he himself was concerned with the issue. And he shared some of his concerns in terms of his safety and so on. And my comments to him was, it would take the courage of MPs to stand up to the regime, because many of them are scared to stand up to the regime of Tshisekedi to say that whatever was signed was not there. But in terms of civil society, there are many civil society actors who have already voiced their concern, including our center as well. We have already shared the concerns around the bill. People are organizing, and you have to think about the timing. Why did they sign it in December? The Congolese parliament is in recess up until March. So no one is actually there, right? So it would take a call for an extraordinary session for them to come back. Yeah. And it will take an MP to initiate that process. So there are a few MPs beyond the scenes are doing that, but publicly, no one has actually voiced public concern around this issue so far. But the people have, on civil society, in the media, the government is being challenged. And last week, the Minister of Communication, Patrick Muyaya, held a press conference where they indicated that now they will take the document to Parliament, something that they didn't even start with, right? So it means that there is public pressure, that people are questioning what was signed in Washington. They're reading the copy because it's online and asking themselves, why did we go sign a deal that's giving away the future of the Congo without consultation of the people themselves?
So would I be accurate if I said that Trump last month took over the natural resources of Congo? And this month, January, is now taking over the natural resources of Venezuela. Would that be an accurate statement?
It's an accurate statement with an addition. It's Trump and his cronies, because it's a whole Trump machine. And there are many business interests around Trump. And these business interests are hiding beyond Trump. That's why even when I spoke about the Congo, I mentioned Bill Gates. Most people don't know Bill Gates flew into DRC with his private jet last year to sign that $1 billion deal for lithium, right? Most people don't know that Eric Prince is operating in Congo and Sudan, right? So it's important, as we're speaking about Trump, to understand the corporate interests around him, and they are moving from Congo to Venezuela, and it's the common denominator between the two countries is the mineral wealth, right? In Congo, is the lithium, is the cobalt, is the coltan. In Venezuela, is the oil, and they're not even hiding it. In the Congo, Trump didn't hide it in his press conference saying that we're going to make a lot of money. In Venezuela, it's the same. He's not hiding that we are there for the oil. And saying yesterday, I believe, saying that they're going to, not paraphrasing it, they're going to colonize Venezuela, no? Control the country and run the country. That's his word, actually, no? The United States will run Venezuela. So it's very clear that this is actually what's happening, that the Trump administration and his corporate interests around him are controlling Congo's wealth today, and they're also controlling Venezuela's oil. They are attempting to control Venezuela's oil.
And you've been involved with some of the other activists in Venezuela. You've been watching this very, very closely. I know you've been posting about it on Instagram. Folks, you all should also check out our brother's Instagram account, Kambale M, K-A-M-B-A-L-E-M, at Kambale M. What are you hearing out of Venezuela, Kambale?
You know, when the bombing started, that's when we started receiving messages. My heart really goes out to the Venezuelan people. They are very wonderful people. For the past 5 years, I've gone to Venezuela quite a few times, met with wonderful people who've taken me to communes, right? Self-sufficient communes where they grow their own food, they make their own clothes, they have their own currency. That's the El Panal commune. So I met the ordinary people, not the government, right? Just ordinary people organizing, trying to have a better Venezuela. And to get messages from them and videos, right, of like balls of fire in the city, right? The explosion. So they live in Caracas and they're wondering what is happening at 2 a.m. in the town. This reminded me of DRC.
You know? Yeah.
In May 1997, I was in Kinshasa during the taking over of the capital city by the rebels. And I remember that eerie feeling of you hearing the bombing in the city. You don't know what is happening. And then you wake up in the morning and you find out that Mobutu has left and there are these new soldiers into town. So I could feel their pain because I remember that vividly. And they were worried about the situation because they didn't have information. So they also relied on us to share with them what we were hearing outside of Venezuela. And there's information start coming out that the president had been kidnapped in a very undignified way, right? In his bedroom with his wife. They took him and flew him. It reminded me of a story that most people don't know. That this is not the first time the Western powers have done that. You know, France did the same thing in Côte d'Ivoire, right? That they kidnapped the president of Côte d'Ivoire at the time, Laurent Gbagbo, and his wife. Unfortunately, his wife was raped during that kidnapping also. That we finding out an African president lived it. We're seeing today a Latin American president is living it. And in my view, I think we need more than condemnation. And it took me almost 24 hours before I said something about Venezuela, because I was talking to people on the ground who were really worried about what will happen about the country. So if you know that feeling, no matter what someone may believe about Maduro, if he's the right leader or not, if there was free and fair election or not, but to have a foreign country come and kidnap a leader of another country causes trauma that can be solved just by returning him now, right? Now the people of Venezuela are going to live with this trauma of bombing the cities, of uncertainty, and there is no accountability. That's why I said that it's not just a question of let's condemn U.S. action. I think there need to be much more action beyond the condemnation. This has to end. Yeah. We don't want to see another killing of another Allende of 2026, right? We passed the CIA coups and assassination, such as what they did with Patrice Lumumba. We are tired of overthrowing foreign governments. And all of this is happening with U.S. taxpayers' money. The question now for the American people, watching the news, right? Because they are choosing the word carefully. Everyone is talking about capturing. Now, they capture the president. They didn't capture him. They kidnapped
him, right.
A sitting president. This is a violation of a country's sovereignty. Will the American people sit back and allow this to continue? That when you travel around the world, everyone keeps telling you, your country did this to my country. Your country did this to my country. I think it's really time for people to stand up against this and remind the American government of the urgency of now in the United States. That yes. People are not able to take care of themselves. They're not receiving enough pay to pay for the rent, for the food. People don't have access to adequate health care. You know, I just drove from DC all the way down to North Carolina. And what I saw really scared me. People are suffering.
Yeah.
So how are we using the money that's supposed to help the people properly? So it's for the American people to stand up and say, we don't want you to take my taxpayers' money to go kidnap a foreign president. We wanted to build our road here. We wanted to build the hospitals here. We wanted to take care of the people. So it's up now to the American people to stand up and challenge the government's illegal actions in Venezuela, because it is not in the best interest of the people of the United States.
One more area in the world I'd like for us to cover in the diaspora, I should say, that also has caused a lot of questions and raised a lot of questions and caused a lot of confusion, Nigeria. Can you help us out with that one? Is it true that Christians are being persecuted in Nigeria?
The framing of it is interesting. It is true that people in Nigeria are being persecuted, not just Christian, Muslims, and citizens of Nigeria are being persecuted. But before even we get into the context, the framing that the Trump administration has put it, because the framing is to discuss what is going on with the militia group called Boko Haram, right? So that's the engagement. They want to connect the Boko Haram with ISIS, with the war on terror, with Islam. That is not the proper framing, right? Because if you've been following Nigeria, you will know that there is a community in the Niger Delta that's been abused for decades by oil companies, right? Destroying communities as they're extracting the oil, making and causing the community to not have access to clean water, complete destruction of these communities. So there has been a marginalized community in the Niger Delta where some of them have actually sued the Shell oil company for the destruction. So that's one aspect. Boko Haram has used the desperation of population with access to wealth to be able to infiltrate communities. And this is coming directly with the fall of Gaddafi in Libya. After the fall of Gaddafi in Libya, many weapons from Libya went all around West Africa with different militia groups, some affiliated to ISIS. And people will wonder, okay, wait a minute. We heard ISIS in Iraq. We heard ISIS in Afghanistan. Why are we hearing ISIS there? Most people don't know that, you know who brought ISIS to Africa, particularly to Libya? The United States. Don't quote me on that. Just check the archives of the New York Times, where the New York Times had an article during the time of the attack on Libya, where it clearly stated on the front page of the New York Times that the CIA is training ISIS to topple Gaddafi. They actually brought them to Libya to fight Gaddafi. So after destroying Libya, killing Gaddafi, what happened to ISIS? What happened to all the weapons that brought in to Gaddafi? It went all around Northern and West Africa. And in those regions, of course, there are people, you know, I'll say, bloody who have beef with one another, if I have to put it in a simple term that way. But when you have internal conflict and you bring in M16 weapons, you bring in all sophisticated weapons, it creates fire. So Boko Haram has been engaged, not just in Nigeria, but all around that region in recruiting young people who don't have access to prosperity, to wealth, who have been left to themselves, and promising them easy money to engage in these counter attacks on different countries in the region.
Yeah, yeah.
Many Americans may remember that there was a few years ago, even the former First Lady, Michelle Obama, posted on social media, free the girls.
Free our girl.
Right?
Free our girls.
That was the hashtag back then. These women that needed to be freed were Muslim women kidnapped by Boko Haram. Right?
Right.
Today,
right.
We are talking about Christian women, and I'm confused. I'm saying, don't we remember that we wanted to bring back our girls who were Muslim women almost a decade ago, and now we're talking about Christian, and thinking that it's a separate issue. So yeah. that issue, in my view, I don't think that the U.S. military engagement in Nigeria is to free the Christians. I don't think it's to bring about stability there. It's been already shown that even one of the locations where the U.S. bombed Nigeria, there was no one in the area. Right? So they did drop a bomb into an empty space. But I do think it's to have U.S. military presence and engagement in Nigeria. Why? Because the United States right now has been kicked out of three African countries. They've been kicked out of Mali. They've been kicked out of Niger. They've been kicked out of Burkina Faso, where these countries have said, we do not want to have foreign military bases in our country. And Nigeria borders Niger. The area where these insurgencies are taking place is right at the border of these nations. And having military presence there, if we have to follow what the head of the AFRICOM have said, General Langley, he wants regime change in Burkina Faso. He said it in the U.S. Congress publicly, right, during a hearing, right, that we must remove the leader of Burkina Faso. So bringing back the U.S. military presence there is more of a stake around the alliance of Sahel states and the region rather than what is happening in Nigeria with Boko Haram.
Kambale Musavuli with a Center for Research on the Congo, Kinshasa. Follow him on Instagram, Kambale M. I'd be remiss, though. Does Trump also have an interest in Nigeria's oil?
Absolutely. Nigeria has so much oil, right? But what I'm saying absolutely, I keep saying, is the U.S. corporate interest. That's why it makes it hard to connect him directly. It's him with his administration where they are trying to secure natural resources, and we have to know why. The reason why they are doing so is to counter China on the African continent or counter China around the world.
Yeah, Venezuela. Kambale, folks, has talked us through the Congo, Venezuela, and Nigeria. We appreciate your expertise. Please follow him on Instagram, Kambale M. My brother, we will be in touch, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Our dear brother, we're glad to have him with us. Joining us now, our brother whom we often call upon at moments like these, because he is a veteran, and we do well to hear from people in his position, especially after what has just happened in Venezuela. And I know him well enough to know. I mean, I went to his Twitter feed before I even looked at that. I already know my man. I know he was beside himself yesterday. Well, let's start. Malcolm Nance, a Navy veteran, intelligence veteran. Malcolm, so where were you and what were you doing when you heard this, when this first transpired?
You know, the funny thing is, I get up around 3:30 in the morning to write, because that's the quiet time where there's no dogs or anything going on. And I woke up at 2, just a few minutes before 2 o'clock, and something made me look at my phone. Maybe it was a sixth sense. And I looked at it, and the strikes had just started landing in real time. And I was like, oh, here we go. I've been, you know, writing about this on my Substack, my Black Man Spy podcast since August, where I said, hey, the next incident we have is going to be Venezuela. Here's how it's going to unfold. And it unfolded in that way. But of course, I got up and I started about 14 nonstop hours of interviews and writing after that.
Wow. Did you think he would actually do this, that he would go through with something this extreme?
Were you concerned? To be honest, I thought it was overdue. Trump is one of those people who takes dates and time seriously, like, you know, the attack on Nigeria, which he carried out on Christmas. You could see he's the kind of guy who chomps at the bit. This, by the way, is where you see the influence of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, kick in. We don't ever want to do things on specific dates and times that people would expect it, right? Like a major holiday. So, you know, even allowing the Nigeria strike, you know, which your previous guest had talked about, which was pretty much a failure. I mean, we 3 out of the 12 missiles we fired didn't even explode. Their warheads were intact up in Joba. That was a strategic deception operation in which they made us look east towards the Eastern Atlantic Ocean in Africa while preparing this sucker punch that was going to go to Venezuela. The key part of this story is not whether the United States was going to hit Venezuela. By the way, we didn't hit them very hard. We didn't destroy their air force. We only destroyed parts of their air defense system that we needed for that raid. But the real part of the story is, how did exactly we get Maduro allegedly in his bed with 2,000-pound laser-guided bombs blowing up all around the city? His bodyguards, his armed security were Cuban. His perimeter security was Colombian army. I'm sorry, Venezuelan army. You don't think anybody would have gone in and woke up the boss that the city was, you know, 100 targets were blowing up all around? It leads me to believe that this deal that we had with Venezuela was likely a package deal in which he was already taken into custody by his minister of the interior, his minister of defense, and packaged up, ready and waiting for the Americans, and that it was a handoff, not as much as a raging gun battle to go inside and get him. We haven't seen much evidence of that. And the opposition said it was a negotiated transfer. Well, the opposition could be his minister of defense, because nothing in the Venezuelan Ministry of Defense and the armed forces did anything, almost right, like they were stood down.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But you just blew my mind. You said that Nigeria may have been a distraction as they prepared for this, because Nigeria was a nothing burger. And
recall, they said, General Kane said that Trump wanted to do this on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
And he convinced them to do a strategic deception and strike, you know, out into the deserts of Nigeria.
Yeah. This is incredible. So now here's the other big question. He's going to try to run. Now, yesterday he was saying, Saturday, I'm sorry, he was saying that he had talked to the vice president. They were cool. She spoke out, obviously. Now he's threatening her and he's going to run the country. Really?
Who's going to? You know, it lends that question. You and what army? I mean, yeah. He left intact. Let's make something clear. The only thing he got out of this deal was Maduro, who he brought up on drug charges, exactly like Manuel Noriega in 1989. That's it. Drug trafficking charges. And his wife, who isn't even charged. Yeah. So he did that, and he left the entire regime of Chavistas in place. The minister of the interior is considered far more brutal. He controls the 500,000 paramilitary militia in that country, Diosdado Cabello. And then you have the Minister of Defense, Vladimir Pedrino Lopez. He controls 100,000 people with weapons, including surface-to-air missiles that they didn't distribute or even try to fire at the Americans. People say this is an amazing mission. It was an amazing mission. But there's just, you know, there's an absence of anything that happened until the helicopters landed at the presidential palace. And that's where they took some fire. And we have several wounded. One of the helicopters was damaged. They barely touched on that. But outside of that, the Venezuelan army didn't even come to the fight.
Yeah, that's been reported. They didn't show up. You know, I thought about your colleagues still in service, mm-hmm, and even civil servants. I know everybody was groaning Saturday, like, I hope he doesn't send me down there. I mean, I can't imagine anybody in the military or in the civil service saying, please, God, let me go to Venezuela and run this country, right? I mean, that's just not even...
Well, you got to take that phrase, run your country, out of here. What, according to Marco Rubio, the strategy was to intimidate them on pain of death, right? That we would go back and airstrike and kill them if they did not comply with our wishes to run Venezuela as dictated by the White House. That's what he meant. And then Trump uses the phrase, we are going to run Venezuela until a transition, as a transition. Look, I took part in a major transition. I was in Baghdad in the Republican Palace with L. Paul Bremer when we took over the government of Iraq. There is nothing, not one hair has been removed from Venezuela. Drug boats are loading and moving around. The people are buying bread in the streets and having cafelitos, going out for drinks at night. Nothing has changed on the ground. But by coming out and saying, well, we could strike you, that doesn't work. What if this time they decide to defend their airspace against helicopters, right? And put thousands of people out there with rifles waiting around. It may take a month, it may take 2 months, But no one was really on watch. Okay. Other, there would have been any aircraft gunfire. There was zero. None whatsoever. So if the Minister of Defense takes charge and becomes the supreme leader of Venezuela and he wants to be the hard guy, well, we're going to be start all over from day one. You got Maduro. That's all you asked for. I cut the deal with you. I gave him to you. You came in and picked him up and flew out.
Yeah, and exchange one for another. If he's as bad as you're describing. So now, what about the legality of this, though, Malcolm? What are your thoughts about whether or not the United States military had the right, U.S. government had the right to go in there and do this in this way? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I like this little trick that they're trying to play right now. I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV, but I listen to a lot of them, right? Especially the former military judge advocate generals. They have wrapped this in a law enforcement operation in which the United States Armed Forces were essentially a SWAT team who went to break down the door and bring him to justice. This template came from Manuel Noriega in 1989 in Panama. Same template, right? And he was a real drug trafficker. But then again, so was the president of Honduras, who moved 500 tons of cocaine into the United States, whom Trump just pardoned from a 45-year prison sentence. The man who said he would like to see Americans awash and brush their teeth in cocaine, because Trump says he thought that Joe Biden unfairly prosecuted him and that he needed him for the new right-wing pro-Trump president of Honduras now, who, by the way, is issued an arrest warrant for that guy. So this is absolutely amazing. So this strategy of using the armed forces as law enforcement has no legal precedence whatsoever. The moment, according to the Geneva Convention in 1949, the moment the first shot was fired from a U.S. warship, the state of conflict, which is war, between Venezuela and the United States is recognized even if one party does not acknowledge it. So as soon as we shot, we were going under the laws of war, not under the laws of high-risk warrant of a SWAT team in a city.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So in your experience, too, was this an opportunity for those in the military or those who I don't know how many other people like you were left in leadership. Let's just say that. Should it have been an opportunity for those in the military and those who you came along with to say, no, this is not right and we should not do this?
Well, in fact, the orders to attack were lawful, right? An unlawful order is go kill civilians, right? Patently unlawful orders. It is incumbent upon the Judge Advocate General Corps, which has been gutted of all the senior lawyers in the Department of Defense. Look, they don't even answer to anyone anymore. Now, every answer, even by the Secretary of whatever he calls himself, Defense, is said, addressed it to the White House. We are operating in a dictatorship, and this dictator, he is dictating what is legal and what is not. The military, in carrying out this operation, that was not illegal. There were national priorities that they set. Were they gray area? Absolutely. But not like sinking these drug boats. Those are patently unlawful orders. I mean, you are just murdering unknown entities in a small craft on the high seas and then murdering them again in violation of the international law of the sea, in which any person who is shipwrecked is entitled and obligated to have rescue and to be assisted by anyone who is on the water, not putting a second missile into them so that we wouldn't know you murdered them. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the principal example that the U.S. Code of Military Justice uses is an incident called the U-582 incident in World War II, in which Nazi boat captain wanting the people not to know that his submarine was operating in an area, they didn't want the British to know, went up and gunned down 35 shipwrecked mariners to death and sank the debris. He was executed by firing squad, as were all of his senior officers in the Nuremberg trials.
Wow, wow. Yeah, that's something else. Now, you mentioned the gray area, though. Mm. Does the announcement of Trump and his cronies' interests in Venezuela's oil, does that add to the grayness in terms of the meaning of this and the purpose of this and the motive?
Yes, but only in the sense that there's a difference between policy and action, right? If the president orders an action, I order you to degrade the air defense systems of Venezuela in order that a special operations will penetrate that country and carry out a high-value target snatch, that's lawful. It's lawful. If you say to do it against France, a treaty country, treaties, by the way, have the power of American constitutional law. That's different. You can't do that. That's like saying go invade Greenland, right? Which is a country, which is a territory of Denmark. You're essentially saying invade Denmark and do that. But this is a completely different thing. The United States and Venezuela have had an acrimonious relationship for some time. The soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who are carrying out that mission of go blow up the air defense are not violating laws. The president ordering that could be determined to be a violation of laws, and he could be impeached, or he could be indicted by the International Criminal Court. We'll have to see.
Yeah, but you know, you, Malcolm Nance with us, folks, Black Man Spy. The thing that you said about it being negotiated, because I was looking at some of the photos that came out of the perp walk and him being in custody, Maduro, that is, and he's taking pictures, giving the thumbs up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did that strike you as odd? But now that I hear you talking about a negotiation,
very odd.
That lends credence to that. Like, you know, yeah, no big deal. I'm here. Right. That's what we were set up for.
You got to fight. Look, I mean, we just pardoned a guy who brought in 500 tons.
Right.
Maybe there is something at play here we don't know about. I am of the belief there's more than enough. If I were giving an intelligence assessment, there's more than enough evidence on the basis of what we know. And more importantly, on the basis of what we don't know. Right. Mm-hmm. In intelligence, we look for black holes. We don't look for the stars. We look for where there are no stars and where all the gravity is bending to a place where there's no light, right? That means something there is stronger than what you can see. And what's stronger than what I can see is, how do you do a 28-minute mission with a guy who has 100 bodyguards and probably another 100 perimeter security and anti-aircraft gun emplacements, local police blocking the roads? Did we kill 100 guys in that raid and manage to do it in and out in 28 minutes? Why wasn't he in a safe room? This is a president of Venezuela, completely paranoid. Full-scale lockdown nuclear-capable bunkers that the Russians had built for him, right? Mm. No, he was already packaged and waiting in an armchair, zip-tied, by probably one of his own senior staff who took control of the residencia and then was like, the Americans come in, and of course we shoot anybody who's got guns. And then we land and we do a handover and then we're off. That's how you do it in 28 minutes, right? You can still have a small gun battle, but inside that guy's already packaged up.
Yeah, yeah.
It has to be. It has to be. Otherwise, where was all of his security? He had Cuban bodyguards. Was he segregated from them and locked away by his own personal minister of defense or minister of the interior, you know, to the point where, you know, he couldn't do harm to himself, could have shot himself, could have armed himself. Somebody's bashing down your front door using 2,000 down bombs. You're going to grab a weapon, right? Not this guy. He just sat around and they said he was in his bed. Look, he wasn't in his bed. You know, desert storms going on outside your window in the middle of your city. You're not sleeping.
You're not sleeping. And Trump essentially said that he was trying to get to some room of steel.
Yeah, safe room. But
he couldn't close the door. And it was his struggle to get him, keep him from closing the door.
Why? Okay. If it takes you less than a minute to go from your bed to a safe room, right? One, you don't take yourself to a safe room when you're a principal of state. Your PPO, your personal protective officer, the guy who is literally sitting outside the door with a perimeter security team outside your bedroom door, right?
Right.
This guy runs Venezuela. He has Russian and Cuban trained intelligence people. Those guys will flood into that room, grab you the way like Trump did when they had the assassination attempt. They will bundle you into that safe room. They will set a perimeter and they will do battle there, right? I think a lot of this is made up. I mean, it just doesn't pass the smell test.
Yeah, a lot of fantasy. You mentioned Russia too. Where does Russia fit in all of this?
I think Russia has leveraged what they're going to get out of Trump by not getting involved in Venezuela. They're going, you know, Trump and Vladimir Putin are like this. The United States is essentially a vassal state of Russia. And Putin, if he was smart, he would say, listen, I'm not going to get involved in this to a great extent, but you will give me concessions in Ukraine. You'll do that. Or maybe I'll just tell people that you asked for me to do this and you were going to give me concessions in Ukraine. But Trump and Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, they all work for Moscow anyway. It's like that song, right? Buys two, right? You know, arrest the president, right? They work for Russian intelligence.
You solve that riddle for us in your work and in your publications, your books over the years. We know that. Yeah, that makes sense. So even all that he's saying to in the background, Trump, I'm not very happy with Putin right now. I'm not very happy with him. That's just show. Vast state. I mean, that's
show. Yeah, let me explain something. Of course it's show. Donald Trump has for years been madly in love with Vladimir Putin. That's what the former prime minister of Australia said. When the first time he saw those two together in a room, he goes, Trump just admires him greatly, just adores him. Trump likes dictators. Trump is acting and wants to be a dictator. He's divided up the world into three poles now. That Alexander Dugin, Putin's philosopher, came up with. Europe to Russia, America, the Americas in the Western Hemisphere to the United States, Africa and Asia to China. No longer a bipolar world where the Atlantic Alliance with the United States is formed. Now they are allowing spheres of influence. And Trump has taken this to heart to the part that he called this thing the Dunroe Doctrine. He seems to think that South America is an untapped vast land. And the commander of Southern Command of Ground Forces called, you know, the rare earth minerals triangle between Argentina, Chile, Brazil, and Venezuela, all of this as resources the United States needs. That's strategic power dynamics we haven't seen since the 60s when we all tried to fight over Africa. But Trump hates black people, which is why he has abandoned Africa completely to China.
Malcolm Nance, folks. Lastly, Malcolm, before we go, what do you think is going to happen next?
Here's what I think is going to happen. You guys may find this funny. When they start bringing Maduro to trial or frog marching him in front of cameras and all that, Trump is going to declare that the war on drugs is over. He's going to say he just ended it. He got the one guy who did it. No more drugs are coming to him. You know, he lies. Trump is a pathological liar. He is the single most documented liar in American history. That is a fact.
Yeah.
That is a fact, right? And he's going to come out and say he solved all these problems and Americans won't be dying from fentanyl. In 2023, 72,600 Americans died from fentanyl overdoses. Most of that fentanyl came from Mexico and China via precursors, or an enormous quantity of it comes from hospitals from overprescribing fentanyl. My poor late wife, when she was in the hospital, had dozens of packs of 100 microgram fentanyl patches, liters of liquid OxyContin, you know, hundreds of OxyContin pills. And one doctor, when I brought it back to show the doctors they're overprescribing, he goes, that's worth $100,000 you have in your arm there, street value. And I said, stop putting it on the street. That's where people are dying. But by the way, that same year, only 26,000 people died from cocaine overdoses or violence related to cocaine. And the Sackler family that created OxyContin from 1999 till today, they killed over a million Americans in OxyContin overdoses. So what are we fighting here? This is really, by the way, and the whole basis of all of this is they're going to kick 900,000 Venezuelans out of the United States now because he's removing their special residency. And here's the kicker. He's sending them back to the same country, same regime that they fled from out of fear. This is about immigration at the bottom of it.
Malcolm X, cumulatively 36 years in intelligence and a Navy senior chief, author of numerous books, including The Plot to Destroy America and The Plot to Betray America as well, and host of Black Man Spy. We always appreciate his experience and expertise. Thank you, brother. We'll see what happens. Thanks for joining.
No problem, Mr. Miller.
All right. If all hearts and minds are clear, it has been made plain.
Thanks for getting woke and listening to Make It Plain. As always, perform an act of kindness on behalf of an elder or young person. Write a letter to a sister or brother who just so happens to find her or himself incarcerated. Offer libations to the ancestors upon whose sturdy shoulders we all now stand. And above all, give thanks to the God of your understanding by whatever name you call her and him. All God asks of us is that we give each other love. Thanks for giving MIP love. And please remember to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. If all hearts and minds are clear, it has been made plain.